I'm Ron Turco. This is a listing of the folks who have worked on this project at Purdue and other places over the last couple of years, and I just want to make sure all the names were mentioned, and actually there's some other names later on in the talk as well. So just to make clarity on what we're talking about here, we're talking about manufactured nanomaterials. We're not talking about clays or anything on that order. We're talking about things that are made that have a working length of less than between 100 and 1 nanometer. That's by definition what a nanomaterial is. It results in new properties and functions. It's allowing for controls on measurements, on size, manipulation of matter. It gives you quantum scale responses. It gives you color change based on size. It gives you properties. It gives you all kinds of things that are entering into what being referred to as some as the new manufacturing and new technologies in terms of things we're building. They're big in electronics. They're big in fabrics. They're big in automobiles. They're big in coatings. Coatings are a huge thing for nanomaterials. They're big in cosmetics. Nanomaterials are turning up there. Fullerenes actually occur in cosmetics now. They're big in carpets for stain resistance. These pants actually have nanomaterials on them. I bought them for that reason. just so I could say that, actually. The zipper broke, though. So, you know, it doesn't really matter. The functionality isn't always the point. But anyway, they're manipulated and they can be built up to make things. So these are some examples of the kind of things we've worked with a bit on different things. Fullerenes, I'll show you a little fullerene story here in a second. They are Richard Smalley and the group won the Nobel Prize for fullerenes. You have spherical fullerenes, which are basically buckyballs. You guys are familiar with those in the left-hand corner over there. Then you have things like cylindrical nanotubes, which are actually buckyballs that don't have ends on them, and they're sort of rounded out. Then you have bucky knobs on them. And there's all kinds of things people can make out of these things. And then the other area that we've just recently gotten into is nanometals. Okay, and if you wanted to pick an area of intense interest in terms of potential for environmental impact, go towards the nanometals. I'll show you why in a second. So the question we've been asking over the last few years is basically on environmental release. And what you have here are two types of nanomaterial. On the left side of the picture, you have products that are available with nanomaterials in them. Anytime you see a product that says something along the lines of reduced bacterial contamination, odor control, stain resistance, there's probably a nanomaterial associated with that. I'm not guaranteeing that, but bacterial resistance tends to associate with nanosilver, and that's a real popular inclusion in products now. Coatings, again, are nano-based materials. And on the right here is actually fullerene in water. Okay, that's really kind of hard to do, but there's a trick to make it go into the water. But that's what fullerene looks like in water. There's fullerene in a couple of those other products you'd never be able to tell. So, but the question we ask is basically about the environmental release and what the environmental impacts of these things. Unfortunately, we haven't convinced anybody to allow us to pay for us to take a nano-based tennis racket and see what it does to soil, but we do work on the other side of that equation. So there is a lot of controversy over nanomaterials, and reaching back a few years, but in the 2007-2008 range, 500 everyday products, that kind of thing. So they're around, they're in there, they're entering the system, the products are out there, and will they become wonder pollutants? This is more recent. Regulation of nanomaterials an absolute must. And so out there looming into our future, I think, is a question about, will nanomaterials actually enter in the regulatory cycle? And nanosilver, to a large degree, actually is there already in terms of EPA's viewing it now as an antimicrobial material. So nanoparticles there. So our question then becomes at a higher scale, what happens to nanomaterials? And this is just a little cartoon. It sort of lays out the scenarios on where nanomaterials go in the environment. If you have my magic fullerenes here, these are gigantic fullerenes. They're the size of a plant, it looks like. But where do they go? How do they get around? Are they leaving the plant? Are they leaving the systems? So we got interested in basically photoreactions, soil reactions, a little bit on this. We didn't do much with this, though. And then looking at degradation impacts in soil and plant materials, and then from the biosolids. And I'm trying to cover those areas here real quick in this story about fullerene. And then my particular area of work, which I'll sort of spin off a little to the side there, is on the impact on microbes and fungi in soil and then wastewater treatment systems. So our work is basically on soils, biosolids, and then we did some straight-up fungal work looking at what's going on. And we mixed into this with some photochemistry as well. And this was all supported by a couple of grants we had from NSF and EPA to look at solubility and sorption, role of sunlight, and the response of bacteria, fungi, and archaea to these systems. And again, listing of the bazillions of people we've supported on this project. So this is what can happen. The question we ask is, what can happen to C60? And that's C60 over there on the left. It's basically carbon-60. That's all that's in there. I think it violates your rule of three. I'll show you why that is in a second. And then we got interested in what was available information-wise about fullerene. And it turns out there was nothing available about the environmental implications of fullerene, so we set out to really to answer that question. So what our suspicion was in soil, was because of my background, was it's going to sorb, or it's going to be converted to something else by microbes or some kind of reaction, or it'll have some kind of metabolite formed, and then will something happen to that? So that was sort of the scenario we set up in terms of what we were interested in looking at. Well, it turns out that that we had no data on C60 in terms of its log KOW value. So Chad Jaffert and his grad students put together a study looking at to develop the log KOW value for fullerene, and it turns out if you look at the big list of high-end log KOW values, it's 6.67. So it's a pretty healthy log KOW value for those who live in that world. It's a pretty retained material. That sort of adjusted our thought on how this stuff was going to behave. Then we also got interested in maybe actually in soil what was going on. So Chad and another one of his grad students in our group put together this work on C60 in soil to look at soil isotherms and behavior. And basically what you came up with is a KOC value estimated at 10 to the 7th. So again, a large number of material, high retention of soil surfaces, and natural water organic matter. So fullerene was probably going to sorb to a large degree in the systems, which was interesting set of findings. We got interested in what happens to these in terms of degradation. How do you break them up? Will they break up in soil? And is this possible? Well, it turns out that let me go back here 1 second. It turns out that C60 doesn't like to play very well. It doesn't do a lot of things. It's very, very, very stable. So the sorption route for C60 is probably the best track for it, with the exception of when you get it into the sunlight. And when you take C60 into the sun, you can have some interesting behavior pattern changes. And this is Chad and Inez Wad, civil engineering at Purdue, working on, that's actually on the roof of their building, and then this is one of their photoreactors. And they were looking at the degradation and the transformation of C60 in irradiated and non-irradiated systems. And you can see in the graph, the open ones are non-irradiated and the closed are irradiated, that you're seeing a decrease in the actual concentration of C60. That's better illustrated in this picture. When you take C60, and when you put it in water, it gets termed NC60. It's a slightly different material. But then you can look at, through time and in radiation, what's happening to the concentration. It's declining. The structure, the material changes, the size of the particle makeup changes, and the mean diameter of the materials actually also is altered. So C60 in sunlight is altered, and what really happens to C60 in sunlight is it becomes a degradation product. And C60 in sunlight actually becomes C60 hydroxy, okay? It becomes a hydroxy material. So it's reactive, and it's converted in light, in water, into this material. Actually, it's usually a little more hydroxylation on it than that. And that is actually going to be from our findings, it turned out that was the two major routes we think for C60 in the environment is the interaction with sunlight to form hydroxy C60 and then sorption, okay, because microbes don't like it very much. And that was shown by some work that Tim Philly did in this project where he looked at specific fungi degrading C60, and we found no degradation of C60. However, when we used C60OH, the product you would see with the sunlight reaction, you begin to see some utilization by fungi. So basically, C60 has to be activated in the sun to be attackable by fungi. So it's a material that's pretty stable until it interacts with sunlight and undergoes some surface transformations. So what Tim was able to show was that you could, in fact, incorporate, this was the first time this was ever shown, with C60 hydroxy, the material that would be reacted, formed in sunlight that in the environment, that you could actually see incorporation of that. This is using C13. You could actually see some percentage increase, very low, of that material into white rot fungi specifically. So there was an ability to some uptake of the material into the fungi. And this graph is utilization of and headspace utilization of the material. And again, you can see changes in the material above the fungi cultures, and you can see utilization is occurring. This was the first time biological utilization of a nanomaterial had been reported. Again, this is for hydroxyfullerene. This is the product that you'd have to have after sunlight interaction. So basically what happens to our, the story we have on fullerene, at least in terms of environmental fate of the material, is that if it enters into the environment, it has to probably undergo a photoreaction or a photooxidation reaction, form hydroxyfullerene, and then it opens up a whole lot of environmental behaviors that are different than the original product. So there's an activation issue involved with this material. C60 itself, or C60 clusters, the way they come when you mix them with water, are probably not all that reactive in the environment. They're going to sorb, okay, given the high KOWs and the high KOCs we see for that material. So if it's in water of any sort, it's going to have to photoreact, be activated, okay, and then once it's activated, there does seem to be a fair population of fungi that will utilize it. Now, and then metabolize it, and then in the formation. This utilization is not rapid, it's not great, it's not a huge amount of material, but that's about the major fate of C60 in the environment. So it's going to remain relatively stable, relatively in place, relatively present in the system, in most environmental systems. So the good news is that it sorbs, the bad news is it doesn't degrade very much. So it's got a long half-life in the system. So our other question in this whole thing was, is C60 have an impact on soil systems and biosolids? Is it toxic to soil systems or biosolids? So that was a separate part of the study. We looked at C60 and CNC60. We'd be looking at single wall carbon nanotubes, which is another big area of interest. This is what has been going into car bumpers. This is airplane parts as well. It makes things lighter and stronger. It's an alternative material they're putting in. We've been looking at nano silver, and we look at nano gallium and nano indium. Okay, and why nano gallium and nano indium? It turns out nano gallium and nano indium are being used in the electronics industry in LED lighting. They're a big component of that. And then the indium is used in photocells to capture sunlight. So gallium turns up in the lights, and then indium turns up in the capture device for sunlight. We worked to do our tox studies on soil. We worked with a couple of soils, but basically a higher organic matter 3.6 and a lower organic 1.5, and we had some other derivatives in there. Standard procedures otherwise, trying to get some contrast on this organic matter issue because of the sorption of the materials. We've used all the proper chosen well methods of assessing things. We've looked at we have markers for three domains: bacteria, archaea, and eukaryotes. We do phospholipid analysis for biomass size and then structure population. We do functions. We do enzymes. We do all the glucose addition stuff you can do. It's respiratory response. All the stuff we've done, and then basically the story comes back. On C60 and NC60, no effect on soil. It's a sad story, but it's a good story. Turns out reviewers do have a little bit of a hard time with no effect. We got them convinced it was okay at some point. So the soil respiration study over that's cumulative soil CO2 evolved in these different systems under different treatments, and this is biomass size after 6 months. No effect from C60 or NC60 in these systems. No expect long-term in terms of what goes on, nanomaterials applied, and then we look at respiration using a substrate-induced response over time. We don't see any major responses there after 6 months either. So really, the carbon materials are having very little impact on these systems. This is a density gradient gel electrophoresis for these different systems looking at bacteria. No effect on structure of the population, no effect from phospholipid analysis either in terms of the material. The other question we raised was on wastewater treatment, and Larry Nyes and I put this part of the study together where we looked at very, very high concentrations of C60, 30 and 50,000 parts per million. We coated the inside of the reactor bottles and then had the biosolids in. We see no effect on biosolid gas production from presence of C60 at these extremely high concentrations. So again, there's not a big impact on these systems. If we feed the systems back or we add different amounts of substrate, we don't see any major impact on the normalized gas production in these systems either. So C60 doesn't appear to have an effect on soils in terms of impacts on soil populations, on soil processes, and then long-term or short-term, we don't see a lot of effect from C60 on these systems. We don't see an effect in the anaerobic digesters as materials as well. So that's a good story. And then we looked at the structure population. We don't see any major differences there using primers for bacteria or eukaryote structure there. And again, very, very high concentrations, just to be sure. We have been looking at carbon nanotubes, and this work just got finished up, and we're in the process of getting that written up right now. Single wall carbon nanotubes, again, they're very popular in terms of new products that are coming out, cosmetics, nanoelectronics, biomedical applications. If you sort of structure the materials, you take a carbon nanotube and you activate the surfaces of these by adding different decorations, as they're referred to by the folks that work with these, to get different structure function on there. Mostly what this does is increase solubility. That's what these things are all about, is increased solubility and then getting them into different kind of reaction sets. So the other thing you find out about carbon nanotubes is they have a little thing that comes along with them called the metal catalyst. Okay, so when you have carbon nanotubes, you also tend to have a lot of metal catalysts coming along, and the catalyst materials are there, and in fact, we had one product we bought, it was called as-produced single-wall carbon nanotubes that was running 30% metal content when we bought it. So it's a very high impurity level in these carbon nanotubes, and that's something, if you're working with these things, you got to be aware of, that they do come with this little bit of baggage on them. We used them as we got them because we wanted to look at the exposure as if you're working with those materials in a typical setting. We also looked at these guys that had the PEG and the PABS attachments on the side. And basically, the story starts to repeat itself again in terms of impact. Even in the presence of these metals, we do see some suppression around the metals, but nothing statistically different. The two soils, this is the drummer, this is the high organic matter soil, and this is the low organic matter soil. This is a typical pattern with these two soils. Nothing weird going on there. The carbon nanotubes were not causing any major problems with the systems in terms of cumulative CO2 evolution. So they again, even in the presence of the metals, are not causing a lot of impact on the systems. And nor are they causing any major issue with the biomass in terms of the size of the populations in the system. So we're not seeing a lot of negative impact there from the carbon nanotubes, nor do we see anything in the profiling. We see a couple of band changes, but nothing significant, I should say it that way. We don't see a significant loss of diversity from the presence of the carbon nanotubes. Let me just throw this out real quick here, because I do think this is really where some attention should be paid in terms of what we've been looking at in terms of these materials. First thing you got to remember is not everything in the world nano is carbon, okay? There's a lot of other nanomaterials out there. And in fact, nanometals may be a major player. They are a major player right now in terms of new products. This is nano silver permeated toilet paper, okay? You can buy this. This is, again, this is the indium gallium solar panels. And this is the lighting systems, the gallium lighting systems. So we got interested in nano silver because of some work we did with some fish populations. A couple of things real quick here. This is two formulations of nano silver that claim certain things on the bottle, but when you actually do the analysis, you find that it's not true. The claim was it was 90% in the size range in the 31 to 40 nanometer range. Well, you see the distribution pattern from the sizing on this thing. This Sigma product was claimed to be, I think, in the 30 range, and that's what you actually get when you do a size distribution. So if you become interested in nanometals, be very careful with what you think you're getting versus what you get in the bottle that you buy in terms of size, because size makes a difference in terms of the reactivity. This is actually a study we just published on nanosilver in response in our flathead minnow larvae, and you can't see it real well, but there are differences with concentration in the response to the system. This is the control, and there is a significant impact at 20 micrograms per liter on these fish populations. You do change the structure of the fish. They do lose certain components. They lose their air sac. They lose their, they have some deformities. They have changes in their population. They're not particularly healthy in the presence of nanosilver. So there is cause for concern with nanosilver. Then if you switch that over to the soils, we looked at soils. This is our low organic matter soil. It's 30-day incubation. This is concentration across the bottom. This is respiration, or substrate induced respiration. You can see a dramatic decline in, significant dramatic decline in the respiration in that system from the presence of that nanosilver. So it's having an effect. We know silver has an effect on biology anyway, but the nanosilver is just carrying the story forward. Now, silver also changes the structure of the population. We can do it from, look at it from a from molecular biology point of view. This is a universal bacterial primer set, and we're seeing bands coming and going. We see a lot of losses. We do see a significant number of changes in the banding pattern and structure of that system, in terms of higher concentrations of nanosilver. So this sort of told us, and we're in the process of trying to get this sort of put together as a paper, that nanosilver in soil could be a problem. Okay, there could be a significant issue there with nanosilver in soil. Okay, well, again, silver has been used for years to do bad things to bacteria. It's a known fact. It will kill microorganisms. The silver ion is a very potent attack on DNA and structure, but the nanosilver kind of keeps throwing off ions, so it's a interesting material in that regard. It does affect soil. The other thing we looked at, again, come back to our other story on nanogallium. We've been looking at that as a pollutant material. Our question there was, if it comes through wastewater treatment and then you apply it to soil, could you in fact impact soil or subsequent crops grown on that soil if it received it as a biosolid? And again, this is the two soils, the Drummer and the Tracy, the typical patterns, and you can see some deviation there. This is in up to 100 parts per million, but when you kick it up a little bit higher, you start to see a decline in respiration from the very high levels, at least in the Drummer soil. Again, nothing wildly out of control, but it is there a little bit. And then here, sorry, this is the right one here. This is on the 1,000 part per million here. This is for the indium, and then this is the gallium. Both of these are drifted down a little bit in terms of the response. So at very high application rates, we do see suppression of soil respiration. So there is starting to see some effect there. Now that's a very high application rate, I admit, but it does suppress CO2 evolution. The other thing we looked at then is in terms of plant response, and this is lettuce response, and then we look across, this is gallium concentration, roots and shoots, and then this is indium concentration here. And you do see suppression of plants at right around 100 parts per million in the application of these materials. For indium and then gallium here, in terms of this is for the lettuce material. So there is a response issue for plants with the metal. It doesn't express itself greatly in the respiration structure from the soil organisms. And you see the same thing with corn, which is, we have plenty of corn in Indiana. I don't think we're going to miss this corn, but it does show somewhat of a downward trend here. And then with the indium, it's even a little, it actually becomes significant with the indium in terms of its response. Again, a very high level. Well, you're starting to see it in the 250 range in terms of the dropout of the system for corn. Lettuce was much more susceptible to the material than corn was. But you see deformities, you see changes in the structure of the plant, that kind of thing. So care has to be exerted, we think, on use of these materials. They offer some great advantages in terms of efficiencies of things, but you just can't ignore the fact that there is going to be potentially an environmental impact from their application. So in summary, I've jumped through all this stuff. We think we've created a pretty good story on what happens with C60, Tim's and Chad's work and our stuff on soils directly. I think we've put a pretty good explanation point on the fact that you need a surface alteration of that material to get it activated, to get it into the system, to get anything to happen. C60 all by itself doesn't really want to play very much. It just sort of sits around. We don't know exactly where it goes. We'd like to know that, and that's something we're trying to sort of figure out how to do. But the products containing real hardcore products containing nanomaterials have not been studied in soil. The major exception to that is some work with some socks in nanosilver in wastewater treatment systems. We are interested in what if you actually put in, if you added real nanomaterials to the soil, what would happen in terms of formulated materials. Our early efforts have shown, we feel pretty confident in this, that carbon is in nanoform is not having a huge negative effect. Now, you can get an effect in culture with it. That's because of some exposure contact issues. But between the sorption to surfaces and other things that are going on and salting out, carbon really seems to have very few negative effects on soil biology and wastewater biology. Carbon nanotubes, their major overall effects in soil are still a little unknown. We're still working through that, but we sort of see the same story developing in terms of the C60 angle we came from, and that nanometals are potentially a major player in terms of negative impacts, and they warrant more study. So that's my story. No, not at all.
At the levels, but the real question is the nanoparticles more toxic than regular silver.
We actually have regular silver is more toxic than nanosilver. If you pick take silver nitrate, you'll get a lot stronger response at lower concentrations.
The other thing is, you really expect maybe 25 milligrams per liter is a lot of silver compared to the usual is like 50 nanograms.
Right. Well, what we were getting that from was some people had asked us about some countertop surfaces they were working with and stuff coming off and wash water and that kind of thing. That's where sort of some of these numbers came from. The real problem we've experienced with this whole set of studies is we don't have any exposure out there to work backwards from in terms of what's real. So we've sort of had to make up our own plan in terms of what would be a starting level for different things. So we realize that some of these are kind of high in terms of their level and effect questions. So,
So I understand how silver nanoparticles might come up from socks and washings. But how do you expect the indium and gallium from solar panels, which are condensed matter, end up in water?
Well, the question there is about manufacturing those materials. If they have a waste stream at the manufacturing plant, they may enter that way, or they, mostly from the manufacturing side of what we're thinking. Now, if you find them in LED lights, they may actually be loose enough in LED structure to come out. I got that from the guys that make those. We actually had a group that works out on gallium and indium at Purdue, and they said there could be enough around that you could get some product out of it, some real metal out of the system. So, again, it's not a huge amount of exposure potential, but again, we look at it from the cumulative effect. If you have a lot of people doing something, you may end up with enough around to be a situation, especially in a concentration point like a wastewater plant. Jay.
Yeah, based on your fluorine work, can we say that maybe the functionalized carbon nanotubes are more biodegradable than the non-functionalized?
Yeah, we would be. I could actually make a phone call and answer that question for you directly, but because we're actually doing that study, they do behave. They're more in the behavior pattern of what you just said in terms of reactive. So once you functionalize the surface, they become more reactive. Yeah, it's that step of getting it functionalized which stops a lot of stuff in the environment with the carbon nanotubes. We haven't looked at sunlight and carbon nanotubes. They're doing that study. Tim and Chad just got a grant, EPA grant, to look at solar interactions with carbon nanotubes. To ask that question, then if you put those in soil, what happens to them? That kind of angle. So, yeah. There's another question for you.
Yeah. Have you or anybody else you know performed any surveys of concentrations of these in biosolids, wastewater, the effluent, know how they partition out? What sort of practical?
There's nothing practical yet done. that makes any, that doesn't sound good, I guess. it's really hard to find, and it's really a difficult procedure to find carbon, any kind of nanotube material or carbon material.
I'm thinking even more the metals.
You can do total metal, and that would be, right now, would probably be the best way to go at it. And there are silver rules already in place. I don't know if there's rules about indium and gallium around.
Yeah, but like silver and biosolids is so inert. It's like not even an issue. It's less of a concern than nitrate. And then you've got the nano, which is potentially a different animal.
It's a little different animal. So that's what we're sort of edging towards now. We actually can, if you apply it directly in, you can see a lot of negative effect. But I think once it reacts in the, once you get it basically suppressed with the organic materials, then you can probably feel a little bit more comfortable with it.
Thanks, Bob.
Sure.